Welcome to this edition of Back to Basics with Pastor Brian Broderson.
Mark's gospel is really Peter's gospel. Mark writes it, but Peter dictates it to him. So some have speculated that perhaps Paul did that same sort of thing with Luke. Maybe, of course, to some extent he would do that. But Luke is going to tell us in just a second that he did his own personal research.
Today on Back to Basics, Pastor Brian continues his study in the Gospel of Luke. Join us as Pastor Brian resumes his teaching on Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 38. Now here's Pastor Brian.
So Herod is an Edomite, but he's married to a Hasmonean princess. He's married to a Hasmonean princess, and he is made king over Judea. So now he pushes back against the Hasmoneans who are seeking, because they've merged the priesthood and the monarchy together, which was never to be done, and they're seeking to maintain that control. But Herod, of course, has more power. He's backed by the Romans. So he pushes them out, and Rome declares him king over Judea, and this all happened through the instrumentation of a person that you will also remember this name, Mark Antony. So Mark Antony is Herod's good friend, and Mark Antony says, you know, we got the perfect person to rule down in Judea. Herod needs to be the ruler, and the Romans voted on it and decided, okay, that's what it will be. And so my point in sharing all of this is that Israel bore very little resemblance to what it had when the last of the prophets had spoken 400 plus years earlier. So it's a completely different place, and the history has just been crazy, full of intrigue and power plays and murder and civil wars and all of this horrible, horrible stuff. Daniel chapter 11 gives us the prophetic picture of what's going to happen. It's kind of hard to track with it, but when you know some of this history, you start to see like, oh, this is what is being talked about here. But here's the good news. Even though, and of course, this has to do with all of the leaders of the nation, the hierarchy, and so forth. You know, whenever you read a history of any country, nobody's going to write a history about you or me. They're going to write about the people in power, the people who had influence, and all of that. And so all of this stuff that we're talking about, all of this was happening with the people who were in power. But there were the common people that were living through all of this political insanity, and there was a remnant among the common people whose hearts longed for deliverance. There's a remnant among the common people, and it is to these that the good news is about to come. That's what's happening now. The Lord is once again breaking forth into Israel's national life, and he's about to reveal himself once again in a way that nobody has experienced for this long, long period of time. And so that brings us to Luke. Now, Luke, we know certain things about Luke from Scripture. According to something Paul said in Colossians chapter 4, it seems that Luke was a Gentile. It seems that he was a Gentile because Paul mentions the Jewish workers that are with him, and Luke's not included in that, and then Luke is mentioned a few verses later. So although it's not absolutely certain, it's probably the case that Luke was not a Jew, that he was a Gentile. He was a traveling and ministry partner of Paul. So in Acts chapter 16, when Paul and his team are going to go from Trophimus to Macedonia, all of a sudden, the writing switches from they to we. Luke is the writer. So what we know is that Luke is part of the team at that point. Was he part of the team before? We don't know. But he is a traveling and ministry partner with Paul. We also know from Colossians chapter 4 that Luke was a physician. He was a doctor. And there are certain things that Luke will say even through his gospel. He will use terms that are actually sort of technical medical terms that indicate his background as a doctor. His Greek was excellent, perhaps the best in the New Testament. There's a debate among Greek scholars. Of course, the whole New Testament is written in Greek, but in some cases it appears like it was written in Greek, but written by a person who maybe Greek was their second language instead of their first. Well, with Luke, it's the opposite. Luke is very, very articulate in Greek, perhaps the best in the New Testament, with the possible exception of Hebrews. So Hebrews is known as the Greek is quite sophisticated in Hebrews. So, but it is the same with Luke. So it seems that Greek was his mother tongue, and Luke has a formidable knowledge of Scripture. Luke knows the Scriptures, and he knows especially the Greek version of the Scriptures. So many of the passages that Luke will use in referring back to the Old Testament, they will be passages that are taken from the Greek translation. Eusebius, the early church historian who lived in the 300s, he said that Luke hailed from Syria. That could be true. Syria was not like today. You know, when we think of Syria today, we think of a country. Syria was the region at the time. As a matter of fact, Jerusalem was part of Syria, part of greater Syria at the time. So perhaps he was from Syria. Luke writes, Craig Keener, the scholar, he said this. He said, Luke writes to readers in the Greek world or Greek-speaking upper-class Rome. His readers are well-to-do and literarily sophisticated and possibly require confirmation in their faith or arguments that they can use to defend it. So this is just some of the background on Luke. Now, remember, Luke is a traveling companion of Paul. And some people have speculated that there could be a huge amount of Paul's influence on Luke's writing. Just like there is the theory, which is probably fairly accurate, that Mark's gospel is really Peter's gospel. Mark writes it, but Peter dictates it to him. So some have speculated that perhaps Paul did that same sort of thing with Luke. Maybe, of course, to some extent he would do that. But Luke is going to tell us in just a second that he did his own personal research. And so we see that as he begins his gospel. Many have undertaken, he says in verse 1, to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the very first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you. Now, I don't know, how many of you were here this morning? Okay, remember this morning, maybe you remember this, in when I was talking about what inspiration means, we talked about how God used the thoughts. He used the background. He used the experience. He even used the research of others to communicate his word through that. That was a reference to Luke. Luke is telling us that he did his own personal research. Now, Luke tells us here that others had already taken these things into account. So most people believe that Mark was written first and then Matthew. So Matthew and Mark are, in the minds of most scholars, that they exist at the time of Luke's writing. So when he speaks of other things being written, that is perhaps what he's referring to. He does say, though, many have undertaken to draw up an account. So not just two, but others have done that as well. But Luke is going to put his, we've already seen what kind of a person is, he's going to put his investigative powers to work. And this is what we're going to see as we go through Luke. Luke has material that Matthew, Mark, or John do not have. And he has insights that seem came to him through personally interviewing certain people. He has insights into, we're going to see real quick here, he has insights into the things that happened with Mary, the things that happened with Elizabeth and Zechariah that the other gospel writers do not give to us. So most believe that Mark and Matthew have been written by the time Luke decides to write. Most believe that he wrote in probably the 60s of the first century. He carefully investigates, as he says he does. But then notice, he says, I decided to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. So this is written to most excellent Theophilus. Who is Theophilus? Nobody knows who he was. Some people say Theophilus isn't really even a personal name here, that Theophilus is being used as a way of just speaking. The word means lover of God. So some say Luke is just writing to all the lovers of God, whoever they might be. Maybe. But when he says most excellent Theophilus, I think that that probably takes it down to an actual person. And his use of most excellent seems to mark him as a member of a high class in Roman society. So it could be that Theophilus was Luke's patron. It could be that he was helping Luke financially, sort of underwriting his ministry, maybe even perhaps helping him be able to have the time to write this out. But Luke is writing this for Theophilus that he might know the certainty of the things you have been taught. The certainty of the things you have been taught. These things are certain. Everything that we're going to read, everything we're going to study, these things, they really happened. There is that certainty to them. Now, historians, and Luke is writing, interestingly, he's writing as an evangelist on the one hand, but he's writing as a historian. Luke is a historian. And even today, modern historians look back and look at Luke as a first-class historian. Oh, there was a time when people used to suggest that the Bible was full of historical mistakes and so forth, but those days are long gone. That's all been disproven. And now you find people say, well, Luke, you know, he was really something else. And indeed, he was. So historians customarily introduced a narrative by listing the names of reigning kings or governors, which provide the approximate time of the narrative. And I love this about Luke. He is right on this. And we're going to see in verse 5, he begins with that. In the time of Herod, king of Judea. So it's in the time of Herod. So Herod came to power in 37 BC. And he lived, we know, at the time of the birth of Jesus, and he probably lived a couple of years after the birth of Jesus, because when he sends out the edict to slaughter all of the male children in the district of Bethlehem, he says that they are to put to death all the male children 2 years old and younger. So it is possible that 2 years had passed since the birth of Jesus. So, and it was shortly after that that Herod finally died. Now, when Luke tells us that Herod was the king of Judea, we've already kind of looked at that history. So this is problematic. We have an Idumean, an Edomite, who is now the king of Judea. But that's only part of the problem. Herod was a brutal, ruthless ruler. Herod murdered his favorite wife. He had 10, but he murdered his favorite wife. He murdered 3 of his sons, numerous family members, and then, of course, he murdered all kinds of people. And it was always rooted in his own paranoia of losing power. He murdered his sons because people tricked him into thinking that his sons were trying to overthrow him. They weren't, but he thought they were, so he made sure they couldn't do that. He killed them. It was Caesar Augustus who said about Herod that it was safer to be his pig than his son. So, and I think it's important for us to remember that the gospel came into that kind of world. You know, we're living in a world that's, I think we can all safely and accurately say, it's getting more screwed up by the day. I mean, noticeably. It's getting crazier. And now, look, it can get a lot crazier, because as far as I know, politicians aren't killing each other and killing, you know, potential threats to their position or whatever. But this is the world that the gospel, this is the world that Jesus came into. And it's the world that Jesus is in today. And it's the world that Jesus is working in today. So it was in the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah, who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife Elizabeth was also a descendant of Aaron. Now, remember, Aaron is the first high priest. Aaron is the brother of Moses. So Elizabeth is a descendant of Aaron. And Zechariah belongs to the priestly division of Abijah. So in the time of David, David took the priesthood and he divided the priesthood up into 24 different groups. So Zechariah is part of one of those 24 groups. There's an estimated 18,000 priests that are living at the time of the writing of the New Testament. So the service that Zechariah is going to perform would be a service that he would perform once in a lifetime, more than likely. And so this couple, Zechariah and Elizabeth, their names, by the way, are significant in their meaning. Zechariah means the Lord remembers. And Elizabeth means the oath of God. So you see, even in that, there's a little bit of something being spoken through the people that were first introduced to. And so both of them were righteous in the sight of God, observing all the commands and decrees blamelessly. But they were childless because Elizabeth was not able to conceive, and they were both very old. They were both very old. How old were they? We don't know. There's been different things suggested, maybe 60s. I used to think that was old. I no longer think that. But back then, I guess, you know, it was kind of old. They were old. I think the main point is Elizabeth has her whole life, she's been barren, and now it's like it doesn't matter because she's too old to have a child. That's what's being expressed here. Once when Zechariah's division was on duty and he was serving as priest before God, he was chosen by lot according to the custom of the priesthood to go into the temple of the Lord and to burn incense. And when the time for burning of incense came, all the assembled worshipers were praying outside. So when you think of what the temple looked like, there would have been the veil. Now, at this time, remember, there's no Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is long lost. Mm-hmm. But there still is a veil. We know there's a veil because we know it's torn in two at the death of Jesus. But in front of the veil is the altar of incense. And so he would serve there at the altar of incense. And then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled and was gripped with fear. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to call him John." So now remember, 400 years have gone by. No angels have appeared in the past 400 years. No prophets have arisen. They've gone through the routine year after year after year with no intervention from the Lord. And suddenly, this righteous priest, and when it says he was righteous, it just means that he was serious about his commitment to the Lord, unlike the high priesthood that ruled over him, who were basically criminals. But he was sincere, and it's to him that this angel appears and startles him, understandably. But the angel says not to be afraid. Your prayer has been heard. So it's interesting that the prayer that's specifically being referred to here is the prayer for a child. Now, I would imagine that included in that would be the prayer for deliverance for the nation. That's probably part of it. As we've seen, both of them are old, well advanced in years. Is Zechariah still praying that prayer, or is it that was a prayer that he had had for so long that had yet to be answered?
For the month of October, Back to Basics Radio is offering a book titled, Is Christmas Unbelievable? 4 questions everyone should ask about the world's most famous story by Rebecca McLaughlin. It's easy for the holiday season to draw our attention to shopping, parties, programs, and events, while the Christmas story is relegated to the status of a myth or fairy tale for children. But is the Christmas story actually grounded in history? Well, in her book, Is Christmas Unbelievable? 4 questions everyone should ask about the world's most famous story, Rebecca McLaughlin tackles 4 basic questions surrounding Christmas. She deals with questions surrounding if Jesus was a historical figure, if we can take seriously the historical accounts of the gospel, if the virgin birth can really be believed, and why it all matters. If you know a person who is skeptical that the Christmas story is true, or if you are a skeptic yourself, we encourage you to call us right now at 1-800-733-6443 or visit us online at backtobasicsradio.com
To order, Is Christmas Unbelievable? 4 questions everyone should ask about the world's most famous story by Rebecca McLaughlin. And when you give a gift to Back to Basics, we'll send you this book as our way to say thank you. We do appreciate your generous support of this ministry. We'd also like to remind you that all of our other resources are waiting for you at backtobasicsradio.com or by calling our request line at 1-800-733-6443. That's 1-800-733-6443. Our desire is to encourage you in your daily walk with God. We'll continue tomorrow with more valuable insights from Pastor Brian as we study together in the Gospel of Luke. Back to Basics is the preaching and teaching ministry of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.